the other concerts are saying. It's really unique, and I think it's an amazing sort of beacon of what we can achieve in this country. And I think people need to take notice of how extraordinary they are. They're not professional, but they are communicating wonderfully. There's a great atmosphere here in the hall, and I think it's vital to education that this kind of thing can happen.
Alison Balsam and John Pickard, thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy part two of the prom. Before that, in each of our live Sunday intervals, we've been hearing from historian Dr. Lucy Worsley as she scours the area around the Royal Albert Hall for interesting things to see. Today, she's crossed the road and she's heading for Kensington Palace.
This is Kensington Gardens on a sunny afternoon. We've got kids rolling each other down the banks over there, people relaxing in the stripy deck chairs, a bit of cycling, rollerblading going on, a lot of people wandering up and down, and quite a lot of them actually turning in here to what's the grand new front entrance to Kensington Palace, where I work as one of the curators. And since March, it's been all new at Kensington. And because of our alterations, people at last can find the way in. It was really difficult to find before. The person who marks the entrance is a white marble statue of Queen Victoria, placed right outside her childhood home. Kensington is where Victoria was born, grew up, first set eyes on Albert, another key moment in the history of the palace, and it was also here when aged 18 and 3 weeks in the bedroom whose window we can see just there, that she was woken up and told that her uncle had died in the night and that she was now the queen, the teen queen. The statue shows her at the age of 18 on her accession, but it was made many, many years later. This statue was created, and this is perhaps the most interesting thing about it, by her daughter, Princess Louise. Now, Princess Louise is just my favourite of all of Victoria's daughters because she was the royal rebel. She was the least princessy of the lot of them. And although it's going too far to call her a feminist or a radical, she did do some quite unusual things for a princess. For example, she went to art school. She trained as a proper artist before. This had always been a sort of nice amateur pastime for princesses, but Louise could have become a professional, probably. She supported women's suffrage. She went to visit the first ever female doctor, Elizabeth Garrett, and she was a big supporter of education for women as well. Now, in some ways, her life was disappointing to her because she got married to a commoner, which was also seen as rather radical and revolutionary at the time. He was the heir to the Duke of Argyll, and he made her go and live in Canada when he became the Governor General of Canada. He wasn't particularly keen on that. They never had any children, as they were fully expected to. And so, you know, her family life was a bit of a disappointment, I think. But instead, she did have creativity. And this, somehow, some of the time, it got her into trouble. For example, her teacher was a sculptor, a professional sculptor, called Joseph Edgar Boehm, and he died. And there was a scandal because she'd been in his studio at the time, and people were saying, what was she doing there? What were they up to? What gave him the heart attack? There was lots of sort of rumours about it, probably all completely untrue. But she did have this reputation as being a bit racy. She would smoke. She would flirt. All the other members of Queen Victoria's court and household loved her because she would liven things up. She would have a little bat chat and scandal exchanged in the evenings. And the other thing that she did that was really quite admirable was that she was tough enough to go to her mother, Queen Victoria, when she was really getting herself into trouble through retiring from the world, withdrawing through her very, very understandable grieving after the death of Albert. But she began to lose popularity really quite seriously and dangerously in the years following by never coming out in public. And Louise was one of the ones who said, Mum, you're not doing your job. You really need to get back to it. And the statue itself was designed by Louise at the invitation of people of Kensington who wanted to do a Golden Jubilee memorial for Queen Victoria. And it's poignant to think that when the statue was opened and unveiled in 1890, by that time, Victoria was an old woman. And she was practically as wide as she was tall. This is our image of Queen Victoria, an old lady in black who looks a little bit like a potato. But here, her daughter has shown her in her prime. She's poised, she's elegant, she's beautiful. I believe that she has actually been slightly beautified. And she's holding up her scepter, she's wearing her crown, she's wearing flowing robes, she's sitting on a seat. She's the epitome of the elegant young queen. Today, the statue is protected by a little pond or a lake that we've made around it to stop people from climbing up and onto it. And actually, climbing up was a problem. Even at the opening ceremony, Princess Louise thought it'd be fun to get 24 little children along, which must have looked very sweet. But some of the boys did try and climb up and had to be brought down again. And one little girl, she looked at the aged and rather formidable Queen Victoria, thought the old queen was going to take her away, and burst into tears.
Lucy Worsley, who'll be back with another quirky piece of local history next Sunday. Well, welcome back to part two of our prom, combining the talents of the National Youth Wind Orchestra and the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain. And the applause and cheers you can hear all around me are for the brass players, now making their way onto the stage. They have the chance to dazzle in more ways than one in part two of the prom. Taking away our breath in five pieces designed to really raise the roof, we're going to be giving the first prom's performance of Wildfire, composed in 1991 by John Pickard. Bramwell Tovey conducted the premiere of that piece. He'll be conducting this afternoon too, as a flicker of musical flame turns the Royal Albert Hall into a raging furnace. Then comes the world premiere of a new work by Gavin Bryars, especially commissioned for this year's proms. It's called After the Underworlds and uses the lower instruments only, everything from tenor horns downwards, evoking not only the mythically murky regions of Hades and the River Lethe, but an area of Leeds where the River Aire is diverted through tunnels under the city's railway station. Principal Hornet gave rise to those cheers. He's James Fountain. Having plumbed the depths, the players saw the heights in Altitude by George Benjamin. And the afternoon ends with Blitz by Derek Bourgeois. And to conduct the first piece, Chorale and Variations by Leighton Lucas, here comes Bramwell Tovey, shaking hands with those seated around the front desks of the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain.
Thank you.
Cossack dance ending that chorale and variations by Leighton Lucas. He composed many film scores, including the score for the Dam Busters, all but the famous march, Eric Coates nipping in to take that accolade. Leighton Lewis was a Londoner who made his reputation as a composer of film music, but who also spent a year as the professional conductor of the Dyke Mills Band. Well, next to Wildfire by John Pickard. This piece was commissioned by the National Youth Brass Band of Wales. This is its first proms outing.
Thank you.
lighting up the Royal Albert Hall. That was Wildfire by John Pickard. Bramwell Tovey conducting the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain and gesturing towards John Pickard, who's over on the other side of the auditorium from me, encouraging him to stand and giving him a big thumbs up. We're turning next to a new piece, After the Underworlds, a BBC commission. This is the world premiere. It's by Gavin Bryars. Ramal Tovey and the lower instruments of the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain, everything from tenor horn downwards, giving the world premiere performance of After the Underworlds by Yorkshire-born Gavin Bryars. That piece dedicated to the Key Brothers, theatre designers and filmmakers with whom Bryars collaborated on an installation in Leeds' Dark Arches that inspired the piece. He's written several works using the imagery of the underworld, drawing on Purcell's Dido and Aeneas and Gluck's Orfeo, the S on underworlds in this piece, making the Greek underworld universal. Well, Bramwell Tovey succeeded Elgar Howarth as artistic director of the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain in 2006. He spent the past 5 years inspiring the young players to give of their best and, astonishingly, is making his Proms debut today. Well, the next piece we're going to hear is by George Benjamin. He found early success when at 16 he was accepted as a pupil at the Paris Conservatoire by Messiaen. He wrote this piece, Altitude, the following year. the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain, Scaling the Heights in Altitude by George Benjamin, composed in 1977, commissioned by Elga Howarth, one-time artistic director of the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain and their third president. This afternoon, Altitude receiving its first proms performance, Bramwell Tovey conducting, and bringing to his feet, first of all, the soprano cornet made by Jack Wilson. For their final work, Blitz by Derek Bourgeois, written in 1980. Bramwell Tovey and the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain, ending their prom with Blitz by Derek Bourgeois. Bramwell Tovey encouraging some of the young players to stand, the principals in the various sections, and shaking hands with Principal Cornet James Fountain. Well, not a brass player himself, Derek Bourgeois was first commissioned to write for the Grimethorpe Colliery Band by Elga Howard. He claims, "I had no idea what brass band instruments were and only a vague idea of what a brass band sounded like, hence providing players with some ferocious challenges, ably risen to today by the players in the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain, aged between 12 and 18. But if you had only a vague idea of what a brass band sounded like, I'm sure your ears have been well and truly opened by this afternoon's prom. There's something really rather wonderful about seeing a whole row of E-flat and B-flat tubas, 10 of them in all, and all the instruments gleaming here in the Royal Albert Hall. Well, since it was founded in 1952, over 4,000 players have taken part in the residential courses that are run in the Easter and summer holidays by the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain. And like their counterparts in the National Youth Wind Orchestra, who we heard in the first part of the prom, young musicians nurtured through the organisation have gone on to take up appointments in leading brass bands and in the brass sections of major symphony orchestras here and abroad. Bramwell Tovey, unbelievably making his debut as a conductor at this afternoon's prom. He's not only artistic director of the National Youth Brass Band, but also MD of the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra. He's conducted the New York Philharmonic, the Boston Symphony Orchestra, the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and the Sydney Symphony Orchestra. He's also a composer. Well, if you'd like to listen to the prom again, you can. It's available online for the next 7 days via the website at bbc.co.uk/radio3. And we'll be back at the Royal Albert Hall live a little later. But for now, I'll hand you back to Jonathan Swain.
Louise, thank you very much. Louise Fryer there at the Royal Albert Hall. And as she was saying, we're back at the hall later for a work that starts with the sunrise and ends with, I beg your pardon, it starts with the sunset and ends with the sunrise. And that sunrise is one of the most powerful and uplifting in the whole of music. It's a rare performance of Schoenberg's medieval love tragedy, Gurrelieder. Rare because of the vast forces it requires. Tonight, the BBC Symphony Orchestra percussion section includes Iron Chains, and there's a choir of some 300 voices. Jukka-Pekka Saraste conducts, and among the solo singers are tenor Simon O'Neill as the cursed King Valdemar, with soprano Angela Denoki making her prom's debut. That's live from the Royal Albert Hall tonight, here on Radio 3 at 8 o'clock. And if you'd like to find out more about Schoenberg's golden gilded Gurrelieder before the prom, we have a Proms Plus feature on the piece, live from the Royal College of Music here on Radio 3 at 6:15.
Music is everywhere. You just have to have the ears to hear it. The words of John Cage, who was born 100 years ago. The BBC Proms marks Cage's centenary with music played from every corner of the Royal Albert Hall. Ilan Volkov curates and conducts an evening of John Cage at the BBC Proms. Live on Radio 3 this Friday night from 7:45.
Back to this Sunday afternoon. It's 6:10 and time now for the next programme in our series featuring Radio 3's starry lineup of new generation artists. Here's Clemency Burton-Hill.
Well, if you were listening a few weeks ago, you may have heard tenor Ben Johnson singing an all Dowland programme here on Radio 3. This evening, we are exploring a different side of Ben's music making with a focus on Italian song. BBC New Generation artist Ben will be joining me in a moment to talk about this surprisingly little-known repertoire. And to kick things off, here he is singing Stefano Donaudi's Vaghissima Sembianza.
Sembianza, tanti cadono.
Stefano Donaldi's Vaghissima Sembianza, performed by the tenor Ben Johnson and James Baglio on the piano. Ben, not a lot of people know Stefano Donaldi's music. How did you come across him?
Well, it's true to say that he's best known for these sets of songs that he wrote, and they are in the style of what we know as aria antiche, which is a strong Italian tradition of song that goes back to Monteverdi, even, through Alessandro Scarlatti and people like that, and the opera composers that came through Italy. And he survives because opera singers sing a handful of them. There are many more. He was born in 1879, to put him in some sort of context, born in Sicily. But his operas, well, his last opera particularly in Naples was so badly received, he was only 46 and he stopped composing altogether.
Tell us about the song we're going to hear next, O del mio amato Ben.
This is the first Donaldi song I ever heard in a recording by Beniamino Gigli. I wish I could sing it as well as him. It's very well known, and singers, sopranos, mezzos, tenors, baritones, have all sung this song, and it's incredibly beautiful.
Oh,
Stefano Donaldi's O del mio amato Ben, performed by tenor Ben Johnson and pianist James Baillieu. Ben, I saw you looking rather emotional hearing that. A piece you love, clearly.
It's so beautiful. I'm not emotional because of my own performance, I might say, but it's really beautiful music. It does sort of tear one up a bit.
Well, we'll come back to Italian song in a moment. We've still got some Bellini to come. But first, you're coming to the end of your time on the New Generation Artists scheme. How do you think you've developed as an artist over the course of those 2 years?
Hugely. And it's nice to sit here talking to you now thinking about that, because it occurred to me on the way in that everything you do is recorded and you get to hear it, particularly when you're working with a pianist like James. In fact, James has played for every single New Gen thing I've done. And he's a great, great musical partner. I couldn't do it without him. And we've learned about how we work as a duo by listening back, recording, tinkering. And my voice has changed significantly, and I've been able to improve my singing by hearing what I'm doing all the time. No, that's not very good, et cetera, et cetera. And he too as a musician, and us as musicians together, as I say. And for that reason alone, it's been an absolute gift.
We're going to be hearing some Bellini next. What's the difference between Bellini the opera writer and Bellini the song composer?
Well, the first thing is scale. These are little Fabergé eggs as opposed to great masterpieces that might hang on a National Gallery wall. And again, there's something interesting here about education, i.e. of the voice. But Bellini was exact contemporary almost of Schubert. And it's interesting to hear Schubert was taught by an Italian, Salieri. The influence of Italian songs, and this is a good example, and I often try and perform Bellini and Schubert in the same recitals.
Tell us what you're singing.
We are going to hear three of the best of Bellini's songs, possibly the most well-known, but there's nothing wrong with that. We start with Malinconia Ninfa Gentile, and then we move on to Ma rendi pur contento. They couldn't be more different. One agitated and restless, the other a little slice of bliss. And then Dolente Imagine, which is very much in the antique tradition, a sort of melancholy about lost love, which pervades all of this repertoire.
Never mind, never mind, Oh.